kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
life. From New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We have a lot to share. We're going to talk about low-calorie diets, reversing diabetes, exercise protecting your heart, in fact, intense exercise protecting your brain, being overweight increasing your liver risk, and supplements found to improve quality of life for female cancer survivors, and a lot more. Then we're going to do a special in-depth original investigative report, Food Fascist, GMOs and Pesticide Manufacturers, Down and Dirty. And we will post this on our website, fully referenced with all footnotes. Then, time permitting, we'll also take a look at several other important social issues. Tomorrow, by the way, I'm going to do an in-depth discussion on the cancer industry. It's too prosperous to allow a cure, as well as debunking the myths of the DPT vaccine. If time permits today, an interesting discussion on liberal Zionism and its end. We're all familiar with conservative Zionism. Well, Anthony Lermanog will talk about that. Also, Muslim leaders worldwide condemn ISIS. You wouldn't know it if you listened to Laura Ingraham, ABC News, Fox News, Sean Hannity and Friends, and others, and Bill O'Reilly. Yes, they are condemning it. We'll give you the proof of that. The Bank of America settlement and the so-called justice, there was no justice. And also, the surprisingly high under or non-reported rate of white-on-white murder. So we take a look at all these things. And this week also, we're going to look at the privatization of water in the United States, how the military, Pentagon militarized the police, and Israel's target is not Hamas, but Palestinian statehood. As you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. I remember, as a young scientist at the Institute of Applied Biology, doing anti-aging research that, quite simply, outside the director, none of the other scientists believe mattered. In fact, they argued that caloric restriction would cause no difference whatsoever. And at the end of a year, by fasting some rats, they were able to live over 20% longer than the match group that ate the normal amount of calories. I then took a group of individuals and I asked them to cut back on the, not the amount of food they were eating, but rather the concentration of calories, meaning you could have all of the food that you wanted as long as it wasn't dense. So fried food out, heavy, all the meat dishes out, cream, butter out. But lettuces, starchy vegetables, legumes, beans, no, whatever you wanted. And I found a remarkable drop in their weight, overcoming a lot of allergens, and they reported all kinds of improvements. The women in particular said that they had more energy, they had less hair falling out, their nails, their skin improved. This was only with caloric restriction. I went on to do four more calorie-restricting diets, but I kept adding something to it. For example, I didn't give any water whatsoever for the entire lifespan of these rats. Instead, I gave fresh organic juices. Now, of course, 97% of juice is water, but it's a very healthy form of water versus just tap water. They live longer. Taking them out of their constricted environments, just letting them run around a gigantic room, they live longer. Playing soft music, de-stressed environment, being creative in the environment. All of these things contributed to a longer lifespan, and hence the reason I came up with a more comprehensive lifestyle protocols that I'm still using today. This is the latest from a major study, and it says low-calorie diet may reverse diabetes. Quote, a new study has transformed thinking on type 2 diabetes by reporting that an extremely low-calorie diet could reverse the condition in just 8 weeks. And this was published in a major journal. Quote, to have people free of diabetes after years of the condition is remarkable, and all because of an 8-week diet, says Professor Roy Taylor of Newcastle University, United Kingdom. Quote, this is a radical change in understanding type 2 diabetes. It will change how we explain it to people newly diagnosed with the condition. It has long been believed that someone with type 2 diabetes will always have the disease and that it will steadily get worse. And we have shown that we can reverse the condition. Under close supervision of a medical team, the people had developed diabetes after, later in life from their diet. And they were put on a caloric-restricted diet. And they reversed their diabetes. Now, for those in this audience, that's absolutely nothing new. As many of you know, you have stated that your blood sugar was normalized without insulin. Your doctor took you off insulin. And that's because historically we thought that a diabetic diet should be having protein 4, 5, 6 times a day. And almost always people either had cheese or meat. And one person I counseled had been eating ham with cheese 6 times a day for over 10 years. Now, of course, other parts of their body are wrecked because of the chemicals and the amount of meat. Their kidneys, their liver, their intestines, their fatigue levels. But they stepped up the high protein. Now we realize that you can get protein from beans, legumes, nuts and seeds, starchy vegetables. So you don't need any animal proteins whatsoever. None. In fact, no one needs animal proteins. And this is a myth. Many of you probably remember a big press conference lecture I did. This goes back 20 years. I did it at the largest auditorium I could find in Manhattan at that time, over 1,000 people at a high school auditorium. I think it was RFK over on the east side. It was to introduce what was called the Egg Project. Little background. While working as a scientist at the Institute of Applied Biology, I was going to do an analysis of the typical diet of people living in South America, especially those that ate a lot of rice and beans, because I could not find where they were suffering from malnutrition if they were eating the traditional diet, not the diet that was high in meat or sugars or sodas, mainly the cosmopolitan diet, but I was focused upon, after my trips down in South America, Central America, the Caribbean, I noticed a big difference between those that lived in the country and those that lived in the city. And there was a huge difference because those that lived in the city pretty much ate the same diet as most Americans do. But the further into the country, the more natural the diet, the longer a person lived, the less disease they had. But rice and beans constituted a big part of the diet, and starchy vegetables like breadfruit. So what I did, I just wanted to see how incomplete beans were and how incomplete rice was. Why? Because every single nutrition textbook in America, including the ones I studied from in dietetic school, said that only animal proteins, meaning dairy, fish, pork, beef, veal, chicken, turkey, were complete, meaning they had all 8 essential amino acids, essential because our body could not produce these. You had to bring them in, and only animal proteins had it. And hence, going back at least 50 years, why our parents made sure that we had protein 3 times a day. And hence the evolution of the diet, like the bacon and eggs, and the grilled cheese sandwich or bologna sandwich. Where I came from, it was everyone ate bologna sandwiches for lunch, and then or Spam. And then in the evening, that's when you had roast beef or chicken. Once in a while, you'd have fish. And that was a staple. No one even questioned it. So I was simply doing a little homework, and I did an analysis, and I made a mistake, and I kept coming up with the wrong percentages. So I left a message for Dr. Berman. I said, who worked in the daytime, I said, could you just double check, see what you come up with? And when I came in that evening, he said, no error, figures are correct. I said, well, they can't be. So I redid my report, and again it came up that both the rice and the beans contained all 8 amino acids. So then I thought, is this possible? This is like rewriting science. This is a major shift towards a different understanding of a protein. So I continued for one more week to see whether or not I had made an error, and I found out I hadn't. So then that raised some very serious questions. Would the scientific community, would the medical community, and would the American people want to know this information? The fact that you have found that they don't need meat doesn't mean that they're going to go along with it because they like the way it smells and tastes and they're used to it. It's a part of our ritual. And then I saw that it was really only young people who were interested in a meatless diet, a few older people, but the vast majority were in it because of ethics, not because of nutrition. Then I started seeing how powerful the meat dairy lobbies were in controlling what gets done at the federal level and state level and school dietitian level. And it was as if you have one truth and a million lies, but the million lies dominate, because that one truth would adversely affect a $200 billion a year industry. At that time, it was $200 billion. So I wrote up the report, and then I thought, well, why don't we make it interesting? Visualize putting your hand in some paint. Now go over to a white wall with some blue paint and put your hand on it. You're making handprint. Visualize your little finger as lysine, and the next finger is tryptophan. Well, if you had 8 fingers, then you would have different amounts of an amino acid depending upon the food. They would all be there, meaning it would be complete, but no two foods are complete at the same percentages, which means that some have greater utilization and others have less utilization. And the rule in protein is you can only use the protein to the lowest denominator. Now, what's that mean? It means, let's say that you have 7 amino acids, you have 99%, but of 1 amino acid, you have 50%. Then you only use all of it to 50%. It's called the laws of limiting amino acids. So then I thought, all right, what other foods will have a lot of the amino acid that another food is weak in? Hence, you make 100%. I found 5,000 combinations of food that when eaten together, like rice and beans and spirulina with anything, would make it complete at a very high level. In fact, I had 5,000 combinations that exceeded any meat dish. In fact, I called it the Egg Project because 3 of the combinations actually exceeded the net protein utilization of the egg, which was the gold standard. In other words, anytime protein was being measured, how much you need, the quality of it, you measure it against the egg. Now, the egg only has about 7 grams protein, but it's like high 90% absorbed, utilized. Net is the total amount protein utilized, so how much you're actually absorbing. And we actually exceeded it, setting a whole new standard in all of science, nutrition science. It took 12 years before any scientific publication, a peer-reviewed journal, finally published it. That's why I decided after about 3 years, the heck with it, I went ahead and brought out the report and I gave it to the public. I sent out to every scientific publication in America, the FDA, MIT, Harvard, School of Public Health, everybody got it, American Dietetic Society. Nobody even responded to it because it was a paradigm changer. In any case, what it showed was that we could live a completely healthy and long life and have less disease if we had a plant-based diet, a vegan diet. The fact that we had the science and we had the math, the economy, and we had the environmental proof that we didn't have to pollute the environment with methane gases from animals, that we were killing 12 billion animals worldwide, over 8 in the United States billion, was unnecessary. Factory farms were unnecessary. And then we started tying in all of the diseases, heart disease, colorectal cancer, breast cancer, premature aging, to eating animal proteins. And by reducing calories and eating living foods, we extended lifespan. So this isn't anything new. This information's been around a while. But the politics of how to control the message and the money behind that is strictly in the hands of the major corporations and the media they control. So I'm glad to see that a person has finally said, we have reversed, and this is a professor, Taylor, Newcastle University, and published it in a peer-reviewed journal, and all that's good, but it won't mean diddly squat. In the real world, anything that causes a person discomfort, anything that demands change, will be rejected by the vast majority of people. But it's good that it's there, because when a person finally awakens and finally says, what, where have I been? Friend, you've been living in a conditioned environment fog. And here's what you should know. Then they can make the changes. So reduce your calories, get off animal proteins, get off the processed diet, and live a longer life and a healthier life. Now, to go along with that diet, it's also important to exercise. There are thousands of articles on the importance of exercise, and one study in particular found that the evidence that nitric oxide generated during physical exercise protects the heart from injury. Emory University School of Medicine has identified the ability of your heart to produce and store nitric oxide as an important way in which exercise protects the heart from injury. Now, anyone listening to this program for a period of time knows that nitric oxide is a short-lived gas generated within your body, and it turns on chemical pathways that relax your blood vessels to increase blood flow and activate survival pathways. And both the chemical nitrite and the nitrosothiols, where nitric oxide is attached to proteins via sulfur, appear to act as convertible reservoirs of nitric oxide in situations where the body needs it, such as a lack of blood flow or a lack of oxygen. And so you exercise, you're protecting your heart from damage. Quote from the study, our study provides new evidence that nitric oxide generated during physical exercise is actively stored in the bloodstream and heart in the form of nitrite, and nitrosothiosols. These more stable nitric oxide intermediaries appear to be critical for the cardioprotection against subsequent heart attack. Okay, this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Circulation Research. Two things. We know that when you drink beet juice, now it may be labeled as beetroot juice or beet juice, it's identical. It is the best source of nitrite in the vegetable kingdom. So having a glass of nitrite juice before you exercise and have some garlic capsules at the same time, then you're creating the sulfur from the garlic and the nitrite from the beet to enhance what you already have, super protecting your heart. And finally, moderate to intense exercise protects the brain. This is from Science Daily, and this is from the National Institutes of Neurological Disorders and Stroke. And this was done at Columbia University in New York, and it was also published in the American Journal of Neurology. Older people, and that means over the age of 40, who regularly exercise at a moderate to intense level, are less likely to develop the small brain lesions what we call silent strokes that are the first sign of cerebrovascular disease. Quote, these silent strokes are more significant than the name implies because they have been associated with an increased risk of falls and impaired mobility and memory problems and even dementia, as well as stroke. And encouraging older people to take part in moderate to intense exercise may be an even important strategy for keeping their brains healthy. All right, I'll add something on to that. I work with a lot of people who have brain allergies, and quite frankly, I think this whole thing of pouring cold water on your head is just stupid. It's because no one's going to do anything about ALS, but it's supposed to be for ALS. Well, who wrote the checks and who they write them to? If you've been writing a check for cancer or heart disease or AIDS, you're writing them, or breast cancer, you're writing for the same organizations that have not been able to do anything except make sure that their paychecks are paid and their foundations and their office rent and their homes all benefit from the public's total lack of awareness that we never ask people to prove the results that we support them in. Rather, show us the effort. So as long as we wear something pink and as long as we shed a tear and as long as we write a check, we're supposed to think, well, gee whiz, that must mean my money. No, let me explain this. Your money is going into someone's bank account who doesn't give a damn about you. These are smart operators. They're clever. They know how to spend the public. I've seen it in the complete corruption of the entire war on AIDS. And I'm willing to debate anyone from the AIDS community at any time on this program to show what kind of sham that money has caused, because the people who are getting well from AIDS-defining illnesses are not doing it because of the money that you've spent or the research. That's all been self-serving. The same is true with chemotherapy. The same is true with heart disease, arthritis, or any form of mental illness. So pouring water on your head, then tell me I saw Bill Gates did it and Mark Zuckerberg did it. Well, exactly what will now happen? Tell me what. Is there a new way of researching it? No. And also, when it comes to these many strokes that people have, did you ever look at the fact that being stressed can cause a mini stroke? When you have an argument, you can cause a mini stroke. When you raise your voice, you can cause a mini stroke. When you're stressed and have cortisol flowing at a high level, that's a mini stroke. So if we explain to the American people our behavior, our arguments are killing us with these mini strokes, then a lot of people would have to ask, is this relationship worth it? Because if you're in a relationship where you argue a lot, then that relationship, in all probability, is going to be contributing to your adverse health. Was it worth it? Did that work for you? I just think that we have this fetish of trying to make something work when it doesn't, and go on with our lives and learn some lessons from our mistakes. I'm Gary Nall. We have a lot to share today. That's our health and nutrition segment. Back in a moment with a special, original, in-depth investigative reporting white paper. Food fascist, GMO and pesticide manufacturers, down and dirty. Richard Gale and myself. After decades of rearing hogs, Danish farmer Pedersen was alarmed at the growing incidence of malformations and biological defects among his newborn piglets. Deformities including gaps in the piglets' skulls, deformed bones, missing limbs, and even female piglets with testicles. Never having witnessed such large numbers of deformed pigs before, Pedersen realized that it was after switching 3 years earlier to Monsanto's GMO food, which had been grown with glyphosate, that these birth defects began to appear. He had the piglets' body sent to a Danish laboratory for analysis. The results were clear. There were high concentrations of Monsanto's glyphosate, pesticide, commonly known as Roundup, in the piglet's organs. The analysis findings were subsequently published in a recent Journal of Environmental and Analytical Toxicology. His experience is another blow against Monsanto's public relations campaign to convince governments and farmers and the consumers that Roundup is one of the world's safest pesticides and poses no risk to animal and human health. For many years, Monsanto has stood by this myth with fanatical religious fervor against all existing independent evidence to the contrary. While there are an increasing number of studies in the scientific literature identifying the health risks associated with GMO consumption and glyphosate independently, no research has yet been conducted to assess the combined synergistic adverse effects of GMOs and pesticides in animal models and humans. The original foundation of agricultural biotechnology was to advance sales of pesticides by engineering crops to become immune to toxic spraying. And while weeds and insect pests would be eradicated, targeted crop would be spared, thereby allowing farmers to spray massive amounts of chemicals on soy, corn, cotton, sugar beets, and other agricultural foods without injury to the crop. This was the assumption that led to the agrogenetic revolution. Only during the past decade, with more and more GM products in the diet and more farm acreage being sprayed with glyphosate and other toxic pesticides and herbicides, are the long-term health risks to animals, humans, and the environment being more fully recognized within the scientific community. Annual runoffs of pesticides into rivers and streams and reservoirs have complicated the extent to which humans are being exposed to life-threatening chemicals on a daily basis. It was never the mission of Monsanto and the cartel of agrochemical seed companies to increase yields and produce that would be drought-resistant. The evidence of higher GM crop yields was an afterthought. However, data are now coming in from independent agroscience community scientists showing that the years of higher GM yields are short-lived and drop dramatically thereafter to levels far below those yields harvested from traditional or organic farming methods. Glyphosate's adverse effects on this group of piglets is only one example of the pesticide health risks. In a major paper published by Earth Open Source, GMO Myths and Truths, an evidence-based examination of the claims made for the safety and efficacy of genetically modified crops, King's College molecular geneticist Michael Antonio, molecular biologist John Fagan, and GM Watch's Claire Robinson outlined the known health risks now shown to be associated with glyphosate. DNA damage, premature birth and miscarriages, birth defects including neural tube defects, and the absence of large parts of the brain and skull, multiple myeloma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, disruption of neurobehavioral development in children, including attention deficit disorder and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Since the release of this study in the journal Entropy, a researcher at MIT and a member of the Union for Concerned Scientists have discovered that glyphosate is in fact taken by plants from the soil and found in our food, an accusation Monsanto continues to deny. The study says that the negative impact of glyphosate accumulation, quote, is insidious and manifests slowly over time as inflammation damages cellular systems throughout the body. In addition to being linked with problems ranging from cancer to infertility, a connection may also be made to the rising number of adults acquiring Parkinson's disease. A couple earlier studies on individual cases found a correspondent relationship between glyphosate exposure and the onset of Parkinson's disease. There are now growing concerns that glyphosate, consumed by mothers and infants in GM-tainted foods, might be giving rise to the autism epidemic that continues to worsen each year and now stands at almost 1 in 50 children. With each passing year, the body of scientific data challenging the safety of glyphosate expands. In several peer-reviewed studies conducted by researcher Andreas Koresko of the University of Buenos Aires, glyphosate was observed to cause teratogenic impairment of neurosignaling and leading to craniofacial malformations. In early 2014, the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health published a study linking glyphosate runoff in Sri Lanka's water systems to an epidemic rise in a fatal unknown chronic kidney disease, or CKD. Until recently, scientists were unable to offer any evidence of what has been causing this new form of illness affecting the kidneys. Similar observations have been made in El Salvador and Nicaragua, where more men die of this kidney disease than AIDS, diabetes, and leukemia. However, in each regional population studied, Roundup exposure is rampant. Sri Lankan scientists hypothesize that glyphosate, originally discovered to act as a chelating chemical in 1964, takes up toxic heavy metals and binds them in the kidneys without the body's detection. According to the researchers, the buildup of these heavy metals ultimately leads to kidney failure and death. In early 2014, the Ministry of Health in Cordoba, Argentina, noted a dramatic rise in the deaths from cancerous tumors, twice the national average. It just so happens that the elevated rates of malignancies were being reported in those regions where GM crops and toxic agrochemicals are most readily used. GMO's health risks to animals and humans are also being reported more frequently in the scientific literature. Corporate agro studies claiming GMOs are safe will generally rely upon a research methodology that employs a variety of so-called reference diets to the animals under investigation. These convoluted studies are designed intentionally to produce an abundance of data without any standard reference control group. This enables corporate scientists to conflate and distort results. This common industry practice was recently exposed by Claire Robinson at GM Watch regarding a published DuPont study on the safety of its Roundup Ready canola. Robinson points out that poor experimental design is intentionally utilized to cover over toxic effects. A new study in rats conducted by a Dr. Eric Seralini at the University of Caen identifies changes in gene expression in sperm cells capable of altering androgen and estrogen sex hormones. The study suggests that glyphosate may be altering human reproduction. The rate of male fertility in the United States has been dropping steadily since GM foods started to saturate the average American diet. Today, according to the American Pregnancy Association, one out of every six men in couples is infertile. That is the highest level ever. Another major blow against Monsanto has been the republication of Dr. Seralini's earlier paper showing a correlation between severe kidney and liver damage, advanced tumors, and premature death in rats fed Monsanto's NK603 maize in the peer-reviewed journal Environmental Sciences Europe. Seralini's paper has undergone more scientific review and scrutiny than any other study, either proving or disproving GMO safety. With its republication, the paper should officially replace Monsanto's flawed safety study purporting the health safety of its NK603 corn. Monsanto must rely on a veil of secrecy, claiming to protect its proprietary information, in order to avoid revealing to the public its actual data about GMO safety. In the absence of credible science to engage in an honest debate with the scientific community opposing the proliferation of GMOs, the company must resort to the lowest, most vicious of tactics, attacking the integrity of scientists, launching smear campaigns against GMO labeling advocates, organic farmers, cyber attacks on anti-GMO organizations, and threats of lawsuits against state governments and media outlets advocating or even suggesting mandatory labeling are becoming more frequent. For example, supporters of GMOs have recently pressured Reuters to fire veteran journalist Carrie Gillam for reporting fairly on GMOs. With approximately 50% of its revenue generated from the sale of GM seeds, it is highly unlikely that Monsanto will ever admit defeat. Rather, it will use whatever means necessary except acknowledging scientific evidence to silence its enemies. Today, Monsanto is scared to death over its future. Like any psychopathological madman or Wall Street banker, it will use whatever means available to preserve and expand its revenue markets, even if it means inflicting pain, suffering upon Indians, Filipino farmers, rather than acknowledge its technology is a curse to humanity and the environment. Fortunately, during the past 6 months, there has been a dramatic turning of the tide against Monsanto and the GM seed companies. Around the world, Big Agri Giant is recognizing that it is no longer dominant. In fact, the consumer is recognizing that these are hated corporations. The good news is that Big Agriculture's imperial strategy for global food domination is hit with setbacks after setbacks as national and local governments realize that genetically modified foods pose serious dangers to human and environmental health as well as to the national food security. Local populations and farmers who switch to GM seeds are becoming more vocal about the failure of GM promises and want to hold those private companies accountable. Already, 90% of the UN member nations, including most of Europe, either require GM labeling or have banned GMO crops. Hungary officially prohibits GMOs in its national constitution. In Brazil, the world's largest producer of GM soy, the country's leading conglomerate of soy traders, the Association of Vegetable Oil Industries, will no longer accept Monsanto's GMO soybeans. Without having the blessing from the U.S. government and the World Trade Organization, Monsanto's sphere of markets would dry up. Therefore, the GMO industry, in collusion with the U.S. State Department, has had to focus its attention on Africa and South America and Southwest Asia, those regions that appear to be the most susceptible to accepting the GMO myths. As nations take a step back and reconsider the threats of climate change and global warming to future food supplies, GMOs are steadily failing to hold up to the promises of higher yields and drought resistance. To the contrary, study after study lean towards the conclusion that GMO-based agriculture may be the most dismal failure since humans first started sowing seeds and harvesting crops. In June, The Guardian reported that the introduction of Monsanto's Roundup eggplant in Bangladesh is facing widespread collapse, with a failure rate of 4 out of 5 farms. GMO soy and corn are rapidly losing their pest resistance. Bugs and weeds are turning into mega threats to the future of yields of stable crops, which the industrial makers of processed foods depend on. Farmers in Latin America are demanding compensation from big ag companies such as Monsanto, DuPont, Syngenta, and Dow for unexpected financial duress and being forced to purchase larger quantities of pesticides in order to sustain their harvest. In Brazil, after only 3 years of GMBT cultivation, pest resistance has been observed. Similar observations are being reported in Puerto Rico, Philippines, South Africa, the U.S., and in the BT cotton area of Australia, China, India. And last month, American scientists confirmed that rootworms destroying cornfields are no longer resistant to GMO corn. An article in India's Hindustani Times states that, quote, there are over 500 research publications by scientists of indisputable integrity who have no conflict of interest that establish harmful effects of GMO crops to human, animal, and plant health, and on the environment and biodiversity. On the other hand, virtually every paper supporting GM crops is by scientists who have declared conflict of interest or whose credibility and integrity can be doubted. Monsanto's BT cotton in India has been particularly disastrous to hundreds of thousands of farmers. Aside from the oft-reported epidemic of farmer suicide, who fall into debt and poverty after buying into Monsanto's GM cotton, farmer suicides have now reached 270,000. Pest resistance is rampant, further weakening the natural immunity of GM plants and predisposing them to less serious pests. India is also witnessing record numbers of cattle die-offs after grazing on post-harvest cotton plants. Regions with higher proportions of BT cotton farming are confronting grim water futures because GM agriculture requires more irrigation than traditional farming methods. And last March, the Indian state banned BT cotton seeds following a pervasive crop failure. Now, one of the most massive GMO failures spanning a decade has been the deplorable collapse of the introduction of GM corn in the Philippines. The decimation of Filipino corn farmers came to world's attention following the release of the film 10 Years of Failure, which follows the lives of farmers whose family fell into debt and poverty after the introduction of GM corn by the Philippine government in cooperation with the U.S. government and Monsanto. Intent on avoiding a similar fate to Brazil's corn farmers, a Brazilian court banned the release of Bayer's GM corn. The ruling now establishes a new precedent that will make the approval of future GMOs in that country more difficult. And China's recent rejection of GMO corn importation has agri-giants further worried as one of their largest potential markets, China, takes a step back to reevaluate the safety and environmental impact of GMOs. An association between the rapid demise of the bee population and the neonicotinoid class of pesticides has already been proven in the scientific literature. European nations are now banning the use of neonicotinoids to protect domestic bee and other pollinator populations. Recent studies reveal that Monsanto's Roundup herbicide likewise is contributing to the decline of honeybee populations. During the first week of August, Mexican beekeepers in the state of Yucatan won a victory to halt Monsanto's plan to plant thousands of acres of Roundup-ready soybeans. After a careful review of the science, a Mexican judge ruled that GMO soy agriculture is an economic threat and incompatible with the state's honey production, home of 25,000 families involved in producing 40% of Mexico's honey export. The ruling is having a rippling effect across other Mexican states involving honey production. Big Agri's only response to the failures of its genetic experimentation has been to increase the development of new GM seeds to compensate for the failures of the old ones. In addition to genetically engineered seeds to withstand ever higher levels of the pesticides, new traits are being genetically engineered to withstand other toxic chemicals. In the U.S., millions of acres of farmland growing GM corn, cotton, and soy are experiencing invasions of super weeds resistant to every type of pesticide. As pesticide use increases, soy quality is further depleted and yield per acre drops dramatically. The economic cost to farmers are becoming unsustainable as expenditures to fight pests and weeds increase and harvests diminish. A recent trend among farmers to revert back to traditional organic methods is gradually taking hold. This aligns well with the last UN Commission on Trade and Development report warning against corporate-dominated monoculture farming methods and promoting farm diversity and small-scale organic farming as the most sustainable way to feed the world's population. Aside from glyphosate and other pesticides, are being genetically engineered into new lines of GM seeds. New varieties of GM cotton and soy are in Monsanto's pipeline and will likely pass with minimal review through the USDA and the FDA. These new GM strains now include resistant genes to the pesticide dicamba. In addition to glyphosate's long list of human health risks, dicamba, a known neurotoxin, has been linked to adverse reproduction and mental development effects. Against strong public opposition, the U.S. government will also likely approve Dow's AgriScience's new Enlist corn and soy strains, a toxic cocktail of glyphosate and herbicide 2,4-D, best known as a major toxic ingredient in Agent Orange, that has, quote, been linked to cancer reproductive effects, neurotoxicity, kidney liver damage, and birth and developmental effects. Agent Orange contamination has resulted in genetic abnormalities and the death of hundreds of thousands of people. Its use as a bioweapon in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos is a sad reminder of the extremes the U.S. is willing to take at the cost of innocent lives to reach its foreign policy objectives. And now, out of desperation to preserve agrochemical agriculture and the GM corporation revenues, the U.S. government will restruct one of the most toxic agrochemicals known and introduce it back into the American food supply. American acceptance of GMOs has been based upon unproven hypothesis of substantial equivalence for over 20 years. This ruling by the USDA during the early years of the Clinton White House gave GM seed companies a free pass to avoid submitting evidence proving GMO food safety. Since the ruling, claims that GMOs are identical to non-GMOs and non-compliance of safety regulation would apply. Therefore, big agro firms do not have to worry over strict regulatory hurdles, which otherwise apply to other products such as pharmaceutical drugs, processed foods, pesticides, cosmetics, and chemical additives. However, a recent flurry of research is now showing a substantial equivalence is patently false. Alexandria University in Egypt, the Permaculture Research Institute, and the Norwegian Center for Biosafety each found GMO crops to be fundamentally different in their natural counterpart. In addition, new studies have also showed that nutrient levels in traditional and organically raised crops are substantially higher than GMO varieties. Aside from the scientific evidence and popular blowback condemning GMOs, the agrochemical industry is facing other challenges if the U.S. government is unable to assume the leading role in the endeavor to save American agriculture from the major systemic collapse, nor support the agriculture substantially in food security in other regions of the world. Perhaps other nations will. In recent months, Russia has assumed an international leadership role to confront the remaining uncertainties in the debate over GMO safety. Russia has already placed a 3-year moratorium ban on GMO imports. And China, France, and other countries are also conducting long-term studies to determine if these are safe or the same. And that is where we come to. The conclusion is the good news is that GMOs are nothing but propaganda, and increasingly they're being exposed as fallacious. As time passes, more and more research will inevitably emerge to further damn Monsanto and the GMO experiment. It is only a matter of time before the false promises of GMOs will be exposed as orchestrated by Big Agra and the U.S. government to control the world's food supply. This is not to suggest that GM foods will disappear. Rather, we can expect an increase in a new volley of propaganda coming from private industry and the U.S. government, claiming GMO industrial agriculture is an urgent solution to combat climate change and global warming, a global threat worrying national economies throughout the world. We can expect to hear more scientific denialism and junk science promulgated by the White House, the small gangs of scientific determinists funded by Big Agra, and the pharmaceutical industry and major media prostitutes. We can expect to hear ever wider and more irrational claims about how GMO-based agriculture might reduce CO2 greenhouse pollution and save humanity. In fact, this was Secretary of State John Kerry's recent drivel at the U.S. African Leaders Summit in early August, urging African nations to, quote, concentrate on existing farmlands to make them more productive rather than expanding and developing new lands for agriculture. Kerry, who has repeatedly proven to be a worthy successor to Monsanto's former mouthpiece, Hillary Clinton, frequently regurgitates Monsanto's propaganda during his foreign policy circus roadshows, and expect new trade agreements written by corporations such as Monsanto to be rammed through the international community by the U.S. and its allies to espouse the Washington Consensus to enforce international acceptance of GMOs. I'm Gary Nall, and that is our original report. Now, to conclude today, I want to share a few thoughts from the research that has been done by the Washington blog addressing the issue of, we're told that Muslim leaders are not helping, they're not doing anything to condemn ISIS or the Islamic State. It's simply not true. ABC News' Laura Ingraham, Fox News, Sean Hannity and friends, and other media commentators say that Muslims are silent and complicit in the barbarian crimes of the Islamic State. Fox News host Andrea Tantaros said that all Muslims are the same as ISIS and implied that all Muslims should be met, quote, with a bullet in the head. Why don't we hear Muslims condemning the barbarian ISIS terrorists? Turns out they are loudly condemning, but our press is not covering it. Father Elias Melin of the Catholic Near West Welfare Association explains, quote, why aren't Muslims speaking out against these atrocities? Well, the answer is Muslims have been speaking out in the strongest terms condemning the crimes against humanity committed by ISIS and others in the name of Islam. Vatican Radio, an official Vatican news site, reported last month two of the leading voices in the Muslim world denounced the persecution of Christians in Iraq at the hands of extremists proclaiming a caliphate under the name Islamic State. The most explicit condemnation came from Armeed Mandi, the Secretary General for the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. The group represents 57 countries and 1.4 billion Muslims. In a statement, he officially denounced, quote, the forced deportation under the threat of execution of Christians, calling it a crime that cannot be tolerated. The Secretary General also distanced Islam from the actions of militant groups known as ISIS, saying that, quote, they have nothing to do with Islam and its principles that call for justice, kindness, fairness, freedom of faith, and coexistence. Meanwhile, Turkey's top cleric, the spiritual successor to the caliphate under the Ottoman Empire, also touched on the topic during a peace conference of Islamic scholars. In a not-so-veiled swipe at ISIS, Mehmet Gormez declared that, quote, an entity that lacks legal justification has no authority to declare war against a political gathering, any other country or community. And he went on to say that Muslims should not be hostile towards, quote, people with different views, values, and beliefs, and regard them as enemies. Gormez said death threats against non-Muslims made by the group formerly known as Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant were hugely damaging. Quote, the statement made against Christians is truly awful. Islamic scholars need to focus on this because an inability to peacefully sustain other faiths and cultures heralds the collapse of a civilization. The Independent noted, quote, Muslim leaders in Britain have condemned the extremist group Islamic State and of Iraq and the Levant, expressing, quote, grave concern at continued violence in its name. Representatives from both Sunni and Shia groups in the UK met at the Palace of Westminster and relayed their message to the militant group. It does not represent the majority of Muslims. Safi, the Muslim Council of Great Britain, said, quote, violence has no place in religion. Violence Has No Religion. 100 Sunni and Shiite religious leaders in the UK produced a video denouncing the Islamic State, saying they wanted to, quote, come together to emphasize the importance of unity in the UK and to decree ISIS as an illegitimate, vicious group who do not represent Islam in any way. Two prominent Muslim leaders are urging Muslim men not to join the radical jihadists. Quote, the public have to be critical. This is not about establishing a caliphate or Islamic State. Then they went on to condemn them. An organization of 29 million members is more modern, well-known for educational activities and avoids politics. Secretary the Moti said ISIS does not represent Islam. Quote, that's my point. This movement is not the context of religion, Islam. We all need to question the group's goals. Don't just follow radicals who try to win their own wars in other countries. We will be the ones to suffer losses. Now, I've only given you, because of time limitations, a few. I have dozens from the Council of American Islamic Relations and many others who are condemning, strongly condemning, all the radicalized efforts from these terrorists around the world. So the next time someone says, no one's saying anything, yes, they are. The question is, why aren't you reporting it? I'm Gary Nall. We're at the end of our program. I want to thank you all for listening. Have a nice day. Let's say hello now to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're talking about what's happening behind Sharpton's public outcry for justice in the Eric Garner and Michael Brown cases.
Good. I look forward to that. Right now, Utrice Lead.